And the quick next idea was, Dad, what about unicorns? And given the industry and the significance of the term unicorn and also the number of unicorns in my house, it made sense. And so I stuck with it and I'm rolling with it at this point. And it took a while to get used to say with a straight face, I'm Kyle from the Unicorn Group. But at this point, it rolls off the tongue naturally.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Kyle Gassaway from Unicorn Group, and we're going to talk about ERPs today, actually. We're going to talk about some of the good, the bad, the interesting ways that people decide to deploy ERPs at the sometimes age-appropriate moment of a business. But before we get into that, Kyle, maybe we'll just open things up. Maybe you could just tell us something about you that not many people know.
Yeah. Hi. Good morning, James. Thank you very much. I'm honored and excited to be on the podcast today. When it comes to something people don't know but maybe should know, I'm going to steal this from my wife. I am from Oklahoma, born and raised, which is the bluest state, or the reddest state, excuse me. I then moved to Vermont, which is the bluest state, and I now live in Colorado, which is the greatest state. So that's been my geographical journey through the United States.
Yeah, very topical. You guys, I'm not sure what way I would have voted in the U.S., but you guys really take your election seriously. It has to be said, for good or ill, it's been all over the news. And I have to admire, like, it's always spoken upon, this sort of democracy in the world. And it can get testy, but I guess that means you're engaged, right? In a lot of places, they're not engaged at all. They don't have blue or red states. No one, hardly anyone knows that there's a small group of people running the whole show. So you have to admire that about the US system.
Yeah, admire is a unique word, particularly right now for me. But I'm glad it's over and the people have spoken and the country will move forward as such. So
I think everyone is glad it's over, to be honest, and you can get on with business. So great. So Unicorn Group is a great name for a company. I maybe thought ice cream parlor. No, but it's a fractional CFO consultancy.
I like to call this the Unicorn Group a startup CFO firm for Colorado founders and funders. It has a unique name and being unicorn. And the origin story with that is a year ago exactly, almost to the day, when I decided to drop out of corporate and hang a shingle and work with early stage startups to really set themselves up for success through the capital or the venture capital journey and growth and startups. And Saturday morning, I was talking to my family about, hey, kids, I have two young daughters. At the time, they were 7 and 5. And I was like, Marley and Maisie, Dad's going to be starting a company and I need to come up with a name. What do you girls think? And they said, Dad, what do you think about the mermaids? And I was like, oof, I guess we could probably do mermen, which they said was a merman. And we scratched the idea. And the quick next idea was, Dad, what about unicorns? And given the industry and the significance of the term unicorn and also the just number of unicorns in my house, it made sense. And so I stuck with it and I'm rolling with it at this point. And it took a while to get used to say with a straight face, I'm Kyle from the Unicorn Group. But at this point, it rolls off the tongue naturally.
I think it's a great name. And I think it does a lesson there, because naming things in computer science, they say there's only two hard problems. One is something called cache invalidation. And the other thing is naming things. And naming things is actually surprisingly difficult. If it makes you slightly uncomfortable, I think that's a good sign. Like any business I've seen of it can't, otherwise you're just into the whatever techno babble of everything else. So Unicorn Group stands out. Congratulations. You did well in my mind.
Yeah, thank you. And I have no doubts that I did, just based on the originators being my daughters. With that sort of peace of mind, I can move forward.
Yeah, that makes it all special. If you'd hired some brand consultant, I'd be significantly less interested, but you got the backup story there. It makes it authentic. So you mentioned there, you've got a background. We should fill in on a little bit of your background and your credibility here. So maybe you can tell us a bit about how you got qualified and what your early career was like. And then we're going to dive into some of your experience around some of your later experience around ERP implementations, good and bad.
Okay, great. I am the offspring of two CFOs, both my mother and father were CFOs. My mom was at a math book company called Saxon Math, and my father was at a laboratory. And so growing up, my mom and dad always told me, Kyle, you know, accounting is going to be a good degree where you can get a job wherever you want and have financial security. As a young man, that was always super exciting to me. Not really. But when I went into college, I did pursue an accounting degree, and it has proven to be everything my parents forecasted it to be. When I was in Vermont, I worked at KPMG. So I'm a classically trained auditor there. Got my CPA license and spent time there through senior auditor, and it was a wonderful experience where I've met friends who I still call friends today, 20 years later. They had invaluable experience, and plus just the resume boost of having Big Four, I consider invaluable. And so when I left public accounting, I jumped into the world of startups. It was exciting. I was still a young man. And now that I'm getting older, I still find the world of startups very exciting. But that was the time of Groupon. And so I jumped into a company that was essentially a Groupon clone. And that was my first dip into the startup world. It was self-funded. We raised and spent $5 million in the course of 18 months and then closed up shop. The first experience there was a pretty epic failure that we left a pretty big divot in the ground, which is not atypical in the industry.
What they're there for, startups, right? So not all of them are, you only hear about the successes, but the other side is you need those. If there'll be no risk, there'll be no reward. So that's the end of the day. Yeah, I think the Big Four experience is good because it's like a stamp. It's people sometimes who say, I got into a certain college or whatever. It means there's certain, everyone knows there's certain IT tests you got to pass to get into those places, etc. So it puts a base level of, let's call it a sanity check or a sanity check on your base competence, which is good. Congratulations. I applied for BWC and despite them and all sorts of things, I failed the IQ test, so I never got any further. So
it certainly wasn't an IQ test, but when it comes to Big Four, particularly audit experience, what I found to be the most beneficial in the real world is essentially knowing the bare minimum to pass audits so that you're not over-indexing on reconciliations, paperwork, process, things like that. And basically precisely what the auditors are looking for, and you can do the bare minimum to pass while continuing to operate the business.
And that benefit had never occurred to me before, but you're right. There's a lot of sort of tax work, accountancy work that I sometimes wonder whether we need to be doing, but that's a big benefit, right? So if, okay, which, you know, what the belly of the beast is like.
Yeah, most of the time, what I found if it seems overly complicated and too time consuming, then it likely is something that you can cut out or simplify and still pass Big Four level audits. And so just knowing, I guess, having an intimate knowledge of auditing standards and GAAP is also a big benefit from Big Four.
Yeah. Now, another CV builder that I've heard people talk about, which is going to bring us onto our conversation here, which is ERP implementation. Sometimes you see this on CVs or people mention it in terms of their experience as a positive, having been through that experience of rolling out an ERP within an organization. It feels like it's a big boy thing to do. If you're going to go your IPO or whatever, it seems like a feather in your cap. You've got three examples here of how to do it right and how to do it wrong from your own lived experience. So what's your take on why people just default towards implementing ERPs in the first
place? I think it's a few reasons, and one of which you touched on. It's a big boy thing. Like you said, it's big, it's bulky, it's expensive. And a lot of times people are led to believe it's what's right for the business earlier than it's right for the business. And why would people consider implementing an ERP and going through what could be 6-12 month process? We're talking tens of thousands of dollars. And when we're at startups, capital is scarce and precious. And so I don't think it's a wise investment to be doing that in back office systems. As far as why, I think there's a promise that it can do things faster and easier. And I also think that there's a little bit of ego involved. When a company gets to a certain stage, different departments have systems that they invest in. So sales has Salesforce, marketing has HubSpot, and then you've got finance and they're still sitting on books and they're like, I want a big fancy system too. And you've got the NetSuite people breathing down your neck, Sage Intacct, saying like, how can you possibly be GAAP compliant in 3 years and go public if you're in QuickBooks? QuickBooks isn't even GAAP compliant. And you just hear all these nonsense scare stories and success stories. And I think it's easy to drink the Kool-Aid. In practice, I think it truly is toxic Kool-Aid when it's not done right and not done at the right time.
Yeah. And you shared an article with me before the interview on it, claiming that 75% of ERP implementations don't achieve the business outcomes that they were tasked with. So I guess it's an open secret in a way. A lot of ways, a lot of people know it's a very risky thing to do, especially if you're new within an organization, like often fractional CFOs are. Last thing you want to do is just get retained and then go in and recommend you spend another 50 or 100 grand on more software to do what they thought you were hiring. They thought they were hiring you to do, right? As part of.
Yeah, I don't want to hate on the ERP community too much, but it does feel like a bit of a racket where they sell you the base license and then, oh, you wanted that module. That's going to be X dollars. And then, oh, you wanted that module. And then now you have all of these modules and you can't maintain that yourself. So you need to get a developer. We have a systems package or a services package. Well, it was a $10,000 budget. So now you're spending $30,000 and you've got a part-time service provider just managing the damn system.
I love your restraint there. I thought you were going to be restrained and then you just gave it right in the face to the European providers, but that's good. So let's not just have opinions here because you've got a lot of good experience. We're going to talk through some of your experiences, how you've come to form these opinions, if you like.
Yeah.
So the first one, maybe to kick us off with a NetSuite implementation that you first came across.
Yeah, we'll go back quite a few years. The year's 2012. It's ex-KPMG, almost my first foray into the public world for the operating a private company. And I joined a pretty large, it was more of a scale-up at the time, Series C. They raised north of $80 million. I was employee number 220, hired as a divisional controller, reporting to a controller who reported to a CFO. And I moved to Colorado for the job. It was in Denver. The company is now public, and so they've seen a lot of success between 2012 and 2024. But at the time, I was tasked with basically a handed a NetSuite implementation that was about 8 months underway, converting from three QuickBooks instances, a US-based, and then two subsidiaries. I think it was a Canadian and an Australian. So they were consolidating that into a NetSuite instance. They were excited about all of the multi-currency and subsidiary roll-up functionalities and the ability to use purchase orders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I was handed the implementation saying, hey, Kyle, can you basically tie this out and make sure everything's good? And in the course of tying everything out and making sure everything was good, I realized that nothing tied out and everything wasn't good. And so that led to basically a rip out of this implementation, who was led by an employee who I was hired to replace. We lost our implementation specialist in the course. And then we ran out of our service hours. Our services contract had expired. And so there we were, boy, I think $45,000 or $50,000 into an implementation. We're still reporting out of QuickBooks because it wasn't functioning. We're out of service hours. So we're needing to sign another service contract just to get someone to get the implementation working so that we can use the system. So I spent the better part of a year getting that wrapped up, tied out. And it was a lot of money and it was a lot of work. We ended up hiring, let's see, two administrators. So we had a senior administrator. And then, of course, he needed an employee to do the work. I think he just gave orders and, you know, how that works. But it became a very big, bulky, and I would argue unnecessary piece of software at the time. And so that was my first kind of eye-opening experience on what an ERP implementation was, particularly with the big ones, what that actually means and the juice you get for that squeeze.
Yeah. Okay. And it's not to say that there can't be business value unlocked by doing these things, but it feels if you're on that IPO track, it's just a default thing you got to start doing because everyone else has done it. You're saying that QuickBooks isn't GAAP compatible, is it possible to go public without moving to?
I'm certainly not saying that QuickBooks is not GAAP compatible. So I'm not going to go on record. QuickBooks is completely GAAP compatible. Those are just some of the reasons I've heard for why you need to get off QuickBooks and go on to big ERP. And it's a lie that's pushed.
Okay. If someone said that to me, I'd be like, I believe you. It seems like a rebel thing, but not necessarily true. Yeah. Okay. And then the next project was Sage. So Sage is more popular on this side of the world, actually in Europe in general, but I believe Interact is their sort of European, it's the next step up from their SMB product. And what was your experience working on that project?
Yeah. So I've had experience with Sage now at two startups, true startups, Series B and beyond. The first, again, I came into a company that had a lot of problems, and the problems weren't back office system problems. They were more like we're running out of money and the business may go under problems. And we had difficulty when I came in being able to report numbers out of a Sage Intacct instance that, again, was implemented. It seemed to work. No one knew how outside of the implementation specialist we were paying money to stay on through a month of retainer. And so when I joined that company to essentially address the dumpster fire and try and get things in order so that we can operate and succeed, it was, I don't feel extremely comfortable, but I'm just going to do it. It was a complete disaster and a nightmare to the point where I did a pretty quick assessment on the Sage Intacct instance. And it was hands off the keyboard, don't touch it. It will take it as it is right now. We're going to bring in QuickBooks, which we know works. Everyone knows how to use it. And we know we can report out of. And we'll just take care of any sort of balance sheet reconciliations at that point in QuickBooks at the subsequent month of which we're closing. The heartache there with Sage, and I just have to say it, I've told them that I would say this, is when you decide you want to cancel your Sage license, you lose all of your data and they don't make it easy for you to get your data out of there. So you have to have a really good plan on data migration, and it's likely isn't loading historicals into your new QuickBooks instance, which I would advocate for. They don't make it easy to leave either, which I think they know. And so that makes the decision even more difficult.
Yeah, that's pretty insane in this day and age to keep your data, not give it to you after the period. That seems very antiquated.
They'll give it to you, but you have to write like a JSON query, and they just make it really hard.
Right. Okay. So straight away, you need to hire another programmer to put it in a spreadsheet for you.
Infuriating. Yeah. My wife knows about Sage Intacct, and she's an attorney who has nothing to do with finance or accounting. And it's just because she hears me screaming about it so much.
That's a business practice where you get to the scale of Sage. It's easy for someone in mid-management to make a decision that they hit their KPI. We're just going to make it less easy than it needs to be. And they're far enough away from the brand manager to make that decision. So you can see how it can happen, I guess. Okay. Then as kind of proof to your point, your last case study shines a light on what you can achieve without ever going to an ERP.
That's right. And I'm glad we're talking about this because it really is the central tenet of the Unicorn Group, which is get things right up front, keep it simple, keep it cheap, and have the ability to report as robustly as you need. And so know what's important. I think what we're talking about now is we're still going back in time. And so I'm starting to feel old. But the year for this is 2015, and I'm at an artificial intelligence company way before artificial intelligence is cool. So I'm talking like IBM Watson's on Jeopardy, and people are like, what's the computer guy on Jeopardy? So it was a long time ago. That problem's been being worked on for a long time. And I was at a startup here in Denver, just the coolest company, the coolest employees, the coolest founder. And they were programmers like you. And so there was no ego involved of wanting to upgrade to a NetSuite or a Sage. They're like, they don't even field the call or read the email. They're like, is QuickBooks working? Yes, then we don't have a problem there. Let's keep operating the business. And so when I came in, essentially the first accounting presence, they had been successfully using their QuickBooks to keep track of their transactions, which at the bare necessity level, that's what you do, is you keep track of transactions in accordance with double entry accounting. And they had been doing that. And so as far as cleaning up financials into standard reporting, getting things into a financial model, which was Excel based, which then you could do a lot of fancy forecasting, it was just all pretty simple. And what was exciting about that company is just a few months after I joined, said IBM Watson came knocking with M&A talks, which resulted in successful M&A, great transaction for everyone involved, particularly IBM. I think they more than tripled their API calls overnight by purchasing the company I was at. And what really stuck with me with that is, number one, getting acquired by a Fortune 20 company is going to be the same process if you're $2 billion or $50 million. And so you just really need to be able to produce reports on the fly, as asked, accurately. And I can tell you, having QuickBooks now, not just for that acquisition, but for two other acquisitions, and just the ease of use, knowing exactly how everything works, and being able to just report on the fly was crucial, not only in just the velocity of which the deal got done, but also an acquirer is always on the hunt for red flags. And a big red flag from my area of expertise, which I take serious, finance and accounting, is when you produce inaccurate, inconsistent, or unable to produce any sort of report. Everything should be tracked, monitored, you should know this, that, and the other thing. And what I found with, you know, the big ERPs is things get lost in systems and bogged down, and you can't get here without that. And at the end of the day, QuickBooks does have it figured out. You need a general ledger, you need your subledgers to tie at an account level, customer or vendor level. You need to keep track of your balance sheet reconciliations. You need to know your customers and revenue. And beyond that, I don't think it's a whole lot, to be honest. And so tying on all these systems that promise to automate and make more efficient, what I found is they do the opposite. And so particularly in any acquisition, having a lightweight system that you can easily jump into has been, when you're in the madness, you don't want extra problems. And so that's one way to avoid.
IBM, before OpenAI, IBM were the absolute stars of AI. They were the ones who were doing AlphaGo. And before that, they had a chess program, I think, as well. And they were really leaders and still are the leaders to a certain extent. Their thunder has been stolen by the LLMs. But that was a dream acquisition by a fairly, what you're saying there is fairly also known for being very by the book. If you can get bought by IBM successfully, you really need to have your ducks in a row. And what I heard there was you were able to do all of that out of QuickBooks. which just proves that now, hey, you're not going to be limited by your backend system isn't going to stymie an acquisition. In fact, it makes it sound like it made it easier.
Yeah, that goes back to scare tactics. I've heard people implementing these big systems so that if they get acquired, they will have X, Y, and Z. And what I found is that's just overly complicated. I'm sure there's a time and place for it. If you have manufacturing operations and you're tracking inventory, things like that. But when it comes to a simple operation, I've been in the software world, SaaS, my entire career now. It's just too much. I'm sure they do work great in the right time and place, but for particularly SaaS startups, it's too much.
I'm wondering there if like the brand name of QuickBooks is great, because I guess everyone knows what that is. It's a known quantity. Even NetSuite, everyone knows what that is. It's a known quantity. But like you said there, SaaS, like I know within my industry, there's specific tooling, often quite expensive, like SaaS Optics or a lot of tools out there, which because QuickBooks and the SMB accounting functions do fall short sometimes in terms of when you're looking for SaaS and it can get tricky. So would you say there's a point, how do you fill that gap where, okay, just QuickBooks was thought of SaaS revenue recognition when they were building QuickBooks, fair enough. So how do you bridge the gap between what you need to run a specific type of business and what QuickBooks offers?
Listen, I think the world in, I can say this confidently, is run off Microsoft Excel. And so just being a pro at Excel will get everything you need done.
Okay, so we talked about a little bit about the cons and cons of an ERP and some reasons why you may not need more than QuickBooks in a lot of cases. Let's talk more broadly here about what I like about the start of this conversation, you talked about being an auditor, you realize what's really necessary to get past the audit. But what would you say are the ways that hiring a fractional CFO can maximize value for these stage of companies that you like to work with?
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for that question. I think it's important to keep in mind what the true role of a CFO is, whether full-time or part-time in the startup capacity that I do. And at the end of the day, it's to essentially maximize shareholder value and do what's right on behalf of the shareholders. And so with that, I've actually seen three areas that come into play early on related to accounting and finance that have really led to pitfalls or setbacks later down the road. So they'll make these decisions or indecision around things in the seed Series A time. And then there's Series C, Series D, things are really real. And they'll come back to haunt the companies. And so like the three areas that I would just highlight are the first of which is equity, and particularly around how you manage your 409A. I've seen times more than once, which is unfortunate, where the higher the 409A value, the better the company is doing. And it's my opinion that's simply not true. The 409A should follow a natural trajectory with the company. And so just having an informed opinion on the 409A and knowing that there are inputs that are subjective and you can work with your actuary / valuation specialist to adjust the enterprise value to where it makes sense, not just based on outside factors, but truly working through a valuation model. The second is with customers and pricing. The two core metrics, I guess three, but the two that I want to touch on that really matter for high growth startups are growth rate and retention. And so when it comes to customers, a lot of times we're so focused on growth rate that we sell at all costs. We do big contracts upfront and we have just a gangbusters first couple quarters, first year. But then we come to the sad realization that we may have oversold. And so those contracts either decrease or churn out completely. And then we have a churn problem. And when you have a retention problem, that's a really big problem, particularly if you're looking to raise more money, which is the natural course of any startup. And so getting a basic and then an actual robust understanding of the calculations and mechanics and KPIs behind retention is crucial, because then from your first customer, you're selling in a way that aligns with kind of that hockey stick or the growth and or the retention KPIs that are best in class from a benchmark perspective. And the third case, which we talked about in length here, is staying stage appropriate. And I advocate for staying stage appropriate because the pitfall I've seen is not staying stage appropriate. It's getting excited about $20,000 systems that promise to revolutionize AR collection or and you plug that onto your $30,000 ERP, and then all of a sudden the back office is managing systems and you have an IT person back there, and the CEO and the sales guys just want to know which cohorts of customers are we seeing both positive and negative trends with churn, so we can evaluate or go to market at those points, maybe factor in some macroeconomical things. And you go to the accounting and finance team looking for information to really analyze and put on the headlights to drive and operate the business. And they're just busy maintaining and operating systems that connect to an accounting ERP system, which at the end of the day generate financial reports in accordance with GAAP, which are table stakes. It's not that glamorous.
Can I ask you there about the first item you mentioned, which is equity and the assumptions that go into valuation models? Can you maybe talk a little bit about what those key assumptions are? Because I'm sometimes shocked when there's a lot of talk about valuations for businesses and you go in great detail about your accounting and your EBITDA and your categorizing everything and your different types of revenue. And then at the end of the day, an assumption that goes into a model can be incredibly vague. It's just your SaaS company growing whatever 20%, then your valuation probably 6 to 10 times revenue. It's like all those other numbers are totally washed away by these input assumptions. When you talk about putting a model together, how do you put your assumptions together that actually in a way that makes sense?
So I will keep the scope within kind of the equity component, so like the value, the 409A valuation. And I also have to preface, I am a state school grad from Oklahoma, and I'm about to talk about things that are over my pay grade. That's why people are actuaries and valuation specialists. But when it comes to the levers you can pull around corporate value, it's fascinating when it comes to, you would think it's just, what are your growth projections, top line, cash flow, profitability. There are other components that go into it. There are competitors. A lot of times the competitors are just, they just Google your company and they find competitors and they assume that those are good comps, which are factored into the calculation. Years to an exit. When do you think you'll exit? Who fucking knows really how many years you're going to OR from an exit? Nobody does. So yeah. You're reading a crystal ball. And so what I think is fun is say, okay, if I say that's 8 years, and the probability is 40%, what does that look like? Okay, let's say it's 5 years and 80%, because nobody really knows. I want to test these things to see where the edges are first. And then finally, I think what gives you comfort, particularly as a shareholder in lots of companies, is there's always a discount to bring everything into range. So no matter how wild your assumptions are going into it, they always temper it down to a range. And so everything, and that's the conservative nature of that industry. And so everything always falls into a line, but you want to pay attention to the trend of that line.
Yeah, it seems crazy because I think it's relevant because when it comes to comps we talked about giving equity to staff and team, and oftentimes you have to put a number or give them some guidance and a guidance what that could be worth, which is fair. But then this is where companies get a bad reputation for handing out equity that could be worth something. But then you have to be aware that the assumptions going into these are so broad. It's almost, I wouldn't say meaningless, but like it's so broad that it's, you almost feel, but like one thing I feel bad about is saying if certain people in our company have equity stakes and people say, what would it might be worth? And I honestly can't, it's either worth nothing or it's worth 20 times your current salary. It's impossible to say. And I can't really tell you.
Is that helpful?
Yeah, exactly. Go buy a house with that. That's it. So I guess humans are bad at probabilities. That's what it comes down to. Yeah. And then pricing, because pricing is a thing where, you know, traditional reputation in my world anyway, is you're never charging enough. You should always be, you can always charge more than you think you can, et cetera, et cetera. But you provided a counter example of that earlier in the conversation. We were talking about these European providers who obviously aim to price maximize all the time. The easy answer is put up your prices. That's the default startup advice you hear a lot with people. But how do you put goalposts around that? Because in our own experience, we put up our prices a lot. Then this year, suddenly it started to impact on our growth trajectory because we had just pushed the envelope a little bit too much. What's your advice around pricing? I know it's very generalized, but can you price too high? And how do you know when you're putting your business at risk by doing that?
Yeah. So my response to that would be, when it comes to pricing, I trust my friends on the commercial side of the business. So we're talking the CRO and CMO to tell me what we can price for and what we can reasonably sell. The next question is, okay, in a year, because we're selling renewable licenses, will that renew? What pieces of that will renew? And I don't like to come across as a CF no, and I know everything, particularly around pricing, because I don't. But I know how it shakes out in the KPIs and the financial metrics. And so what I like to do is have an open and active dialogue and educate if necessary on, okay, if we sell this contract now, this is what we have to do to meet our projections or our guiding principles for how we run the business. And it's not lost on me. That's a very emotional topic, particularly when salespeople are compensated on their coin operated, and the more they sell, the more they make. And sure. So the conversation around, hey, let's temper this contract up front, build in some upgrade for the next 2 years. What you have to do is you just have to engage in constructive dialogue and find ways to make that compensation work for the sales team, maybe average the 3-year deal. I think that's part of the beauty of having a team who has different specialties. And pricing isn't one that I have. And I know my seller friends out there know how to sell incredibly well. And yeah. So I think it's just cross-departmental synchronicities there.
That's the thing with salespeople are good at selling. And obviously that comes to their own. You hire salespeople you like to win financially. That's it.
Yeah.
And it's that you want that. Absolutely.
I want them to make as much money as possible.
Yeah. Exactly. But then you got to do that in a way that makes sense for the business as well. And it's the art and science of sort of that comp design to make sure you get there or to realize that you're not overselling, like you said.
It's not that hard, to be honest, to align compensation plans with key metrics as long as you think about it up front. If you don't think about it up front, then you'll build in all of these things that seem natural to a salesperson, but just junk up your KPIs. And so then you're working with definitions and you bring into once you start questioning your metrics, particularly with outside providers, banks, investors, then you're in real trouble. And so you just don't really want to go down that path.
Actually, that point you mentioned there, once you start questioning the metrics, like to your point about that, we have a system actually we use to track MRR, and suddenly for various different reasons, we lost confidence in the data in there. And as soon as you do that, it's like a shiver down your spine. You're like, oh, hold on, that data, I can't rely on it anymore. I don't know where I am. And it's like,
print off the last 12 months bank statements, tell your wife we're not coming home for dinner, get your highlighter, and it's the lifeblood of you can't get that wrong. There's zero margin for error, in my opinion.
Because it makes everything else irrelevant. Okay, awesome. So let's wrap it up to talk a little bit about, you've obviously had all this relevant experience. Where have you really zoomed in terms of your ideal customer now today that you really love to work with?
Yeah, thank you for asking. This has been really fun, James. When it comes to my ICP, which is ideal customer profile, or the people I work with, the first filter is it wants to be someone I want to work with. I've been in the Denver Boulder area, this ecosystem, for long enough that I have a big network of people I really, and also know other people who I will really like and be excited by the work they're doing. And so I want to be excited by the work they're doing. And the founder generally has to realize that finance and accounting isn't an afterthought. It's not something that they can just do and roll their own, which they can do, but they just won't be working with me. And they can come find me in a few years when things get ugly and bottlenecked and I may or may not have time. And so it's got to be someone who understands, or at least understands enough, that there is a problem and you should bring in a professional to do it. As far as stage, I've spoken this earlier. I am Colorado proud, so I work with Colorado founders and funders specifically. And as far as stage, it's right now I have 3 clients I'm working with. One is pre-seed, one just raised a seed round, and one's raising a Series B. And that's really the bookends of the stages that I work at. Once it gets past Series B, I think the ERPs have more relevance and everything I was just shitting on actually comes into play and becomes real. And so I gracefully step away before that happens.
Very good. I have to say, you've done quite a good job between your name, or maybe I credit your daughters with that, Unicorn Group, and then you're unafraid to say, listen, I work in Colorado. I'm unafraid to say I work pre-seed to B, and that's it. And that's actually great, because it's hard to do that, because you're always afraid, oh, what if I'm losing out on X, Y, and Z? But you clearly know exactly what game you're playing, so it makes it easier to market.
Yeah, and I do have to say, as far as a career and professional enjoyment, I'm at the top of my game as far as having fun. It's great. No offense to sales and marketing meetings and going through pipeline review and funnel metrics, just doing pure CFO work with companies who want my advice and need it is a blast, and seeing all the different industries and just seeing the passionate people out there who are going for it. And I get to have a seat on that ride. It's a blast. So it's a lot of fun.
Cool. All right. I'm going to ask you a slightly self-serving question before we get into the business hero, which is you work with QuickBooks. So what's your, in addition to QuickBooks, there's an app store there. I know you don't use Procurement Express, but you do use other tools at the moment. So what are the, your go-to app store recommendations for people who are using QuickBooks?
Yeah, I will just give my plugs, and I have no affiliation with the companies outside of they work. So it's QuickBooks. I use JustWorks for all payroll. They're a PEO. Strongly advocate PEOs instead of rolling your own. You'll go down the same ERP problem if you start going down the roll your own payroll problem with ADP or Gusto. So sticking with the PEO, it works is what I go with. Bill.com for AP and AR. It just works. Works great. And then Carta for equity management. That doesn't have a financial impact. There's no tie-in to necessarily books, but those are the back-end stack that if you have those, you should be pretty damn close to automated.
Okay. So I have my cap table in a spreadsheet somewhere. What should I think about Carta? What's the advantage there over my locked spreadsheet where we don't let anyone touch?
Confidence, ability to share with both shareholders, internal and external. All of your employees can have their own login where they can go exercise. That's right. Just, and then spreadsheets are great, but that is one place where I would advocate for software over Excel. Is cap tables, because those are that's the most important corporate record. And they just have the ability to A, maintain the cap table, but then there's robust things around doing waterfalls on the fly, modeling out M&A and what the shareholder impact would be to me personally, to whoever's working. And so you can just play around with it. And that can bring an excitement component to employees who have equity, and it's worth it.
Okay, as a management tool, what I heard there, okay, there's an admin side to it, but as a tool for getting people excited about what we're trying to do or trying to understand about what different decisions might make. I'm playing with the idea of opening up our better visibility on the cap table to our entire team and trying to make it more real for them in terms of what success looks like in different scenarios, whether we need to be profit driven. Like I've always said, I just want to run a profitable business. I'm a business nerd. That's all I wanted to do, or built it to be sold or anything. And then every now and again, someone says that business could be worth whatever. And I'm like, okay, if it was that much, maybe. But then I started to think, now I'm being duplicitous. I'm being duplicitous to my team, saying, oh, we just want to build a business we want to hold forever, just enjoy working in. And suddenly if someone comes around. So I'm trying to think about ways that we could say, let's have that conversation together. Like what would it look like for all of us? What money would we have to pay you to not work at Procurement Express anymore? That's effectively what a buyer acquirer would be saying. And there's always probably a number. And I'm looking for a way of extending that throughout the team to say, okay, there is a stage at which it makes sense for all of us to do an acquisition now. I don't have to worry about that today, but maybe I'll get into
it. Yeah, this isn't lost on you, obviously, but sometimes those numbers are less than flattering, particularly for the rank and file. The 0.01 percenters. And so when you say $100 million acquisition results in $13,000 or something, it becomes less exciting. So just walking that line pretty closely.
Yeah, I started to sketch that out, and you realize then, okay, for everyone to really win, you got to just perplexion. So, but we have a remote international team. So I've started to look at it more in terms of, I think it was Mr. Money Mustache actually works down the road for you, the road from you there in Colorado.
Who first Mr. had this Money idea. Mustache, okay.
Yeah, years and years ago, he had this blog post on the rule of 24, which is you got to have 4 times your income to free you up from the need to work, right? So it's basically another version of the 24% rule. If you look at it that way, because it's tricky, if you have an international team and you look at it that way with different wage levels, you realize actually that's the number that matters. And that's a different dollar value depending on where you are in the world and the country, et cetera. And once I started to look at it that way, I was like, actually, maybe there's a way that everyone can get what they want here. If you look at it that way, you know, we all do different things to earn a dollar. That's the weird thing. And yet we treat that dollar to be the same unitary thing, but it's very different.
It means extremely different things to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet we all treat it the same, and we judge each other as if it's the same.
Yeah. One path I'm going down pretty diligently right now, I'm in the throes of, is starting a venture capital fund. And our investment focus would be on B Corps and PBCs. Mm-hmm. And basically both those companies put basically sustainability in all wakes of life, not just environmental, but employee, everything ahead of corporate profits. Corporate profits are important, but sustainability and that sort of thing. And it's becoming a really popular concept with companies, even venture-backed companies. And what they do is they take care of the employees. Sometimes equity doesn't matter. Sometimes cash doesn't matter. Sometimes someone just wants someone to pay their daycare for their kids so that they can come to the office. And so offering a daycare stipend. And so it's really more of a humane approach. And it's an area that I want to invest in and give back in. And B Corp designation and everything that goes along with it has been pretty interesting if you haven't looked at it yet, particularly as a CEO who employs employees.
Yeah, that sort of thing in a little bit what's happening much more in Europe here, which is the what they call a CSRD or is a DEI or sustainability focus on businesses. And there's a big push in government here in Europe to focus on sustainability of businesses versus just profitability. That's going through a bit of a brand crisis at the moment, because when you get into the detail of that, you're like, what does that mean? One person thinks it means environmentally sustainable. A person thinks it means that they're like financially sustainable. Another person,
planet, property, I think. Which P is it?
Yeah, that's it. And then you have a lot of these funds, which are sustainable funds. But then what they mean is sustainable, me investing my pension money or whatever in a sustainable fund can mean something radically different. And there's a lot of greenwashing going on. And the trick is, at the end of the day, the greenback is very countable. That's the problem. Like, you can just, it's either there or it's not. And right. All of these other second order factor, maybe second order is the wrong word, but like other factors are just not denominationable, countable in the same way. And that's where all the vagueness comes in. And that's what makes it challenging.
Yeah. And so I see the conflict with that I see is the venture capitalists are very much what you're saying. The greenback counts and that's all. Whereas mm-hmm. the B Corps are like, well, yeah, that definitely matters. But what matters more is that we do this in a good and right way. And yeah. then there are numbers. There are numbers that I've seen recently that suggest that these companies who go down these initiatives have higher metrics in basically everything you could look at: employee morale, employee engagement, profitability, sustainability, cash flow. And it comes down to that bottoms up. If you care, your employees care, and you have a better business. Whether that's mm-hmm. actually true, I can't speak for the facts that I read, but it makes sense to me logically. So I'm going to keep pulling on that thread.
Yeah. Two things there. One is you want it to be true, right? That's a lovely idea,
yeah.
which also makes
Hell
me
yeah.
suspicious. But the second thing is I can see how when people are in it for the money, it's just a different mindset. Like I heard someone recently talk about crypto and how he was really into crypto and how it works and the benefits and so on. And he met someone else, says, oh, I'm into crypto. And he said, oh, what is it? I'm not an expert, but he was talking, is it the blockchain or is it what are you getting excited about? I said, oh, you can make a shitload, ton of cash.
Right now, have you seen? I just cashed out all my crypto yesterday and made like a bunch of cash off of it because I hit my price and it's going gangbusters.
Right. Yeah. Congratulations. Okay. Yeah.
It's just been this crazy train that I got on around 2012. And it's just, it pumps and then it goes down and then it pumps and then it goes down. It's wild.
Ah, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Listen, this has gone a little bit off the tracks here, but that's so fun. It was fun to do. So I'm going to wrap it up then. People can get you on your website or LinkedIn. How can people get in touch with you?
Oh, yeah. LinkedIn's great. Kyle Gassaway. And then my email is kyle@unicorngroup303.com. But reach out anytime. I'm happy to facilitate quick questions and free advice, particularly, hey, we're thinking about going this, or I was told that. Is that true? And I can say, yeah, that is, or no, it's not. And likely offer advice from there. So happy to talk.
So the last question then is your business hero. Do you have one and why?
Yes. As far as business heroes go, I do have a business hero, and it's Yvon Chouinard. He's the founder of Patagonia, and he, wildly successful business. They make great products. They stand behind their products, and they've done it right from the start. They've always had the focus on doing it the right way by the right people on behalf of the planet, on behalf of humanity. And they've been an absolutely exemplary company on how to do it right. And that came down from Yvon. He's also a kick-ass outdoorsman. He does a lot of climbing, everything I want to be. So when I grow up, I want to be that guy. It won't happen, but he's definitely my business hero.
And a long-lived business as well. When did he found it? It's in the 80s, was it?
Long time ago.
Yeah. That's what I admire, those businesses that last, have been around for decades and decades. In my family, my great-grandfather started a bakery that lasted for 140 years. And I was like, oh,
140
cool.
years? Yeah, how great yeah. is that? There were generations of families and kids who went to that bakery, and that's what they'd get to have soup on Thanksgiving or whatever it is. And that's what it's all about, man. That's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. That's my vibe. I love that. I love long-lived businesses. Whatever about the flash in the pan, billion-dollar business over the last 5 years, fair play to them. But I love the ones that were around for decades.
Yeah, life. I mean, that really speaks to me a lot because, and admittedly, I'm not extremely proud of this, but a lot of the companies I've worked at where I was coming into these high growth, high backed, high burn companies, I wouldn't even make friends because I saw it strictly as a project. We need to turn it around and more or less drive as much value out of it as we can, as quickly as we can. And so I was just heads down operating for multiple years more or less avoiding the social aspects because I knew it was all going to be over soon enough and I'd be on to my next one. And that's just not who I am. And diving into the more sustainable aspect is exciting to me.
Yeah, it reminds me of being an expat somewhere. When you're an expat in a country, you don't really invest that much because everyone's moving on. But okay, yeah. I like that.
Pragmatic.
Okay, thanks, Kyle. And thank you for listening this far. Your reward for sticking with us and hanging out with us for an hour or so is that you're able to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. If you're running your business off QuickBooks, Procurement Express happens to work very well with QuickBooks. We're the top-rated spend management solution in their app store. And we all work very well with Bill.com. So frequently, it's a good pairing. A fractional CFO might go in and decide to implement Bill.com, and then they want to put improved approvals on those spends around the purchasing process, along with purchase order issuing and other features, and we help out. So if you want to see a case study on how that can work, you can go to procurementexpress.com/partners. And I've got a webinar on there where we explain how other fractional CFOs have managed to implement that for their clients, specifically in the biotech industry in that case, but maybe it's appropriate for your clients too. Thanks for listening. And thank you, Kyle. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you, James. Take care.